Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our democracy debrief, where we dig into some of the electoral process hotspots following this presidential election. We've looked at the Electoral College in this series and at who gets to vote and how those votes are counted. Today, how the media fits into the picture. And I'm joined by none other than Bob Garfield, co-host of On the Media from WNYC. Hi, Bob. Thanks for joining us for
this. Good morning, Brian.
If a fact check falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did it make a sound?
Nope. It sure didn't. Not only fact checking, but straightforward news in general was suppressed, was blocked out, was not viewed by lots and lots and lots of people who get their news from Facebook. And because of the combination of human nature and the Facebook algorithm called EdgeRank, we are fed more of what we have looked at before and what we have engaged with and what we've shared and commented on. And as a consequence, we all of us are in about 1.8 billion separate echo chambers. And it's hard for the straight dope to get through to us if we are inclined to look at, heavily politically inflected and often invented fake news.
I guess so. But how much does fake news really compete with real news? I know this is certainly the flavor du jour over the last couple of weeks. Where was the talk about fake news during the election campaign, if it was having that much of an impact? And is there a way to measure it against, news that's real news, and then people come up with whatever opinions they come up with?
Well, there is a way to measure it. BuzzFeed tried to figure out the amount of engagement with fake news from various dubious sites and actual bona fide news organizations during the course of some period in, leading up to the election day, and discovered, to many people's horror, including mine, that a handful of fake news sites actually drew more engagement, which is to say commenting, sharing, and simply clicking, than did 12 or 15 so-called mainstream news sources. These numbered in the millions and millions and millions. So it clearly had an effect. Why didn't people notice it? Well, it was kind of hidden in plain view. And, everyone knew it was out there. But I think nobody really appreciated the scale and the significance of something that I must say I've been screaming about at the top of my lungs for a year now, and that is what I call the United States of Facebook, wherein mm-hmm. we all get fed more and more of what we have shown an inclination to look at, and therefore less and less of the real deal. And
so, do you get
it's only one? This is like the canary in the coal mine of a much bigger problem about the survival of the news media.
Listeners, this is a rare opportunity. You hear Bob Garfield on the Media. Now you can talk to Bob Garfield if you want to call 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Everything Bob Garfield has ever said on the radio is on the table. 212-433-9692. But to stay on your point, Bob, is there anything Facebook is going to do about this, and do you think there's anything that Facebook should do about this?
There are some things on the margins that Facebook can do. It can look at where the traffic is coming from, and if it comes from sites that are manifestly phony, that have no news organizations behind them, that are just cutting and pasting and making stuff up, it has ways of identifying that and then suppressing distribution of that stuff. So sure, it can do that. It's loath to do that. And there's a very specific reason it is loath to do that. Facebook claims, for a variety of reasons, that it is not a publisher. Now, it distributes content, more content than anyone else in the history of the world, and it sells advertising against it, so you would think that more or less defines being a publisher. But they say, no, we are a platform. And if they can claim to be a platform and not a publisher, they are held harmless legally by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act from anything that happens that it happens in its pages, in its feed. The moment they say they're a publisher, it opens them for legal and kind of cultural liability that they're very uncomfortable with. However, even Mark Zuckerberg has now acknowledged that fake news is an issue, and he says he's on the case. Mark Zuckerberg says many things, and like a familiar political figure, we can't necessarily assume that the story is going to stay the same tomorrow as it is today.
And while we're waiting for Facebook to do something about fake news on Facebook, we should point out that On the Media has published a fake news edition of your Breaking News Consumer's Handbook. And I thought we might actually go through some of the warning signs that the news you're reading isn't for real. Your first sign is all caps.
Yes, all caps. All caps is a big red flag.
That's not how the Washington Post publishes.
No, not usually. I mean, maybe when the war breaks out or presidents are assassinated or something like that. But generally speaking, no, all caps is screaming. And, you know, it's meant to be attention getting, and evidently it works. But
indication
if you're seeing that, you're probably not looking at the New York Times.
Another one is a glut of pop-ups and banner ads. Another one is the URL has .co added to a trusted name like ABC News. This example, I guess use this example, abcnews.com.co. What does that mean?
Well, it means that you are poaching somebody else's URL and making it look like it's coming from a credible source, but in fact, it's an entirely different registry. It's like one of those fake designer handbags you buy on Canal Street. It might look the same, but it's counterfeit.
One other, if the story makes you angry, it's probably designed that way. But aren't legitimate reporters and editors trying to get you to respond emotionally to their work? Like, take the best investigative report in the New York Times or something where they've uncovered some horrible injustice in some company or government official's attempt to cover it up. And this is great journalism, but it's going to make you angry.
It is going to make you angry, but the point of it is the underlying facts and the reporting thereof. The point is not to infuriate the audience, and the language is not, and the headline treatment is never, or I'll say seldom, done with the express purpose of getting people angry. You know, we're just committing journalism. What we certainly know in social media is that the content that gets the most response is that which does generate emotion, whether it's anger or sadness or sentiment. You know, that's why Upworthy is a business too, because we go, oh, and that's why these fake news things work, because we go, that Hillary, Pizzagate, you know, it's...
Was that your Mr. Burns imitation?
It was not, but I suppose, you know, I mean, if anything should happen to Harry Shearer, here I am.
Linda in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I had this thought the other day. It just dawned on me that I pay for the New York Times subscription so I can see it online. And the thought arose to me was, if everyone had to pay for all the news they consume, but not just paying their internet service provider, but actually pay for subscriptions for all the news they consume, would the whole landscape change? Because would people really take a moment to think about, am I paying for real news or fake news, or what am I paying for?
Boy, you know, it's so funny, Bob, before you even address the content of Linda's question, how the groundwork has shifted on this. Remember when the internet was new and the mantra of progressives was the internet has to be free, and any attempt to charge for anything on the internet was seen as a commercial encroachment on sort of the, you know, the grassroots Wild West of information. And now you get not just Linda in her phone call, but a lot of people saying, no, if real journalism is going to survive, since people generally get their news online now, not from print edition newspapers, if journalism is going to survive, we have to make people pay for things. Otherwise, there's no business model.
Yeah, the irony is so thick, you could cut it with a tweet. Linda, my response to your question is, yes, if only I had wings, why then I could fly. You have hit on one of the fundamental problems, not only of journalism and media in America, but democracy in America. And as Brian has observed, the internet, which seemed to be the ultimate democratizing of media and expression and the marketplace of ideas, has turned out to be kind of incredibly the ultimate concentration of media power. And it, right now it resides in Facebook and Google. And the media economy is in tatters, and it's in tatters partly because people won't pay for the content they consume, because of, you know, mainly because of strategic errors by publishers 15 and 20 years ago, and because the advertising market is in free fall. It's subject to the laws of supply and demand, and news organizations can no longer keep on the lights on the basis of advertising sales. So those have converged to create all sorts of problems. And this is what you've just identified as kind of the collateral damage. The fact that we don't pay for stuff means that we can't be sure of what we're getting. And as a consequence, we don't, you know, if you're not going to your subscription at NYTimes.com or whatever it is, then you don't know exactly what you're getting.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And but it's not a clear matter of right and wrong either, I don't think, because Linda, how would you like it if the rules of your New York Times subscription included that you can't share a New York Times article that you think is important with one of your Facebook friends, if you're on Facebook, unless they also have a paid New York Times subscription? You know what I mean? You can't share an article for free.
Well, but that's where their business model is. You can 10 or 20 articles for free a month.
That's right.
So I think they've solved that, because I do share plenty on Facebook.
Yeah, by limiting it.
Right. I get what you're saying.
You can have, and I hear what you're saying, they do it, they limit it so people can read like 10 free New York Times articles a month, things like that. Bob, I want to turn from Facebook and social media and fake news to the mainstream news media as we debrief the election. Do you think media is learning any particular lessons from the campaign? You checked in with editors at 7 outlets, I see, from the AP to Univision. What did they tell you, and what are their plans?
Well, before I tell you what they told me, let me tell you what we didn't discuss. And, you know, after the election, there was this just vast mainstream media apology tour, wherein we beat our breasts and rent our garments and wrung our hands over how we failed to go to the red states, where we failed to go to the rural counties, where we failed to go to the Rust Belt, where we failed to document the economic and cultural anxiety of the people who would go on to vote for Donald Trump.
But do you buy that?
But no, it's not true.
Oh, I agree. it's not true.
It's manifestly not true.
Because we say that on the one hand.
Embedded.
Right. I mean, it seemed to me there was a big article in some, you know, mainstream media outlet and constant discussion on radio and television about who are these Trump voters, and let's try to understand these Trump voters. And maybe for the Washington Post and the New York Times, it was anthropology. But there was so much sort of normalizing of the people who are flocking to Donald Trump, the white working class, blah, 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 that seemed to go on all throughout the campaign that I don't think.
Yes. In fact, we did so much reporting about the potential Trump voter that we paid very little attention to the actual underlying issues. That's what got short shrift. No, I think the media's biggest problem in covering this election is that we still don't know how to read polls, and we don't understand the difference between the popular vote in the Electoral College and what constitutes political success and what doesn't. And we and as a consequence, we didn't see what see coming what the polls told us very well could be coming. So that was careless in exactly the same way it's careless in every single election cycle. But as to your question, what are we going to do now as an institution? How do we cover Donald Trump, who's a liar? How do we cover Donald Trump, who doesn't know anything about the office that he's about to take over and uses Twitter to communicate with people in ways that upset the cart of diplomacy and who knows what all as he speaks just off the cuff in an unpresidential way? Do we even pay attention to tweets is a fundamental question that we have to answer. I think the answer is we have to, because whatever comes from the mouth of the president of the United States, whether in 140 characters or from live on TV from the Oval Office, matters. And it matters around the world. And it matters in places where they have armies that and economies that can be turned against us. Yes. So
we had
it
this
all matters.
This came up in our last segment. We were talking with Fred Kaplan from Slate about Trump's emerging foreign policy, the thing that he did with Taiwan, the thing that he did with the Philippines, what his generals are saying about Iran, things like that. And somebody called in to say, you're normalizing Trump too much by analyzing him. And, you know, I understand the impulse not to normalize somebody who is so abnormal and outside the usual bounds of, you know, political discourse in this country, and lying, as you say, and all the hate speech in the campaign and other things like that. But then on the other hand, we probably have to see what he's really doing now that he's president-elect and is going to be president of the United States, and talk about what he's doing, even if part of that analysis, as Fred and I did a lot, was to say what he says doesn't mean anything. When he takes a phone call from Taiwan, we have no idea whether that was something that was planned and that's a matter of policy, or something that he did out of naivety and impulsivity, because that's how we don't treat Trump as normal, because he doesn't act within those normal parameters or consistently. So we have to call that out. But you can't just ignore what he does.
Nope. I mean, it is a conundrum because we are trained to ignore the trivial. But normalizing ship has sailed. As you know, Brian, I was agitating for close to a year about the idea of normalizing Trump and his hate speech and his supposed ideas. But, you know, now he's president-elect, and everything he says or tweets does matter. It has real-world consequences. And, you know, I don't think the press has the luxury of being able to say, well, we'll pay attention to this outburst but not this one. Because some 3 a.m. tweet from the bathroom could cause armored divisions to be mobilized somewhere in the world.
But by the same token, it's part of the game that Trump plays to tweet or say things provocatively, set himself up as the villain, because then everybody runs around, oh, did you hear what he said about Mexicans? Did you hear what he said about China? Whatever it is. And we denounce him for some bigoted remark, let's say, but we focus on it and focus on it, maybe missing a bigger picture, a bigger story, something more policy-oriented. And then his popularity.
Like a $25 million fraud settlement that was scarcely covered because we were paying attention to the performance of Hamilton.
Right. But
that's the misdirection argument.
He
may be doing that.
What the Hamilton people said to Pence and Trump's reaction. Yeah. And so he does that. So that's something that we have to take into account, that we haven't encountered before.
It's actually worse than that, because as George Lakoff, the linguist, observed on our program this week, the hate speech and lies, the more they are spoken And no matter how much they are argued against and debunked, even the arguments and the debunking process simply cements the lies and hate speech in the minds of the audience, especially the audience that is predisposed to believing this stuff to begin with. So the very journalistic process of countering some of his nonsense.
Say bigotry.
Bigotry, or simply lies, has the unfortunate opposite effect in the human mind. I mean, let's not divide this by political affiliation. Simply in the human mind, and that's
it. Actually helps build his base. So, is there any answer to that? If you are trying to delegitimize lies by calling them out, but that winds up giving the liar more popularity, what do you do?
Well, George Lakoff's answer was to change the way you frame conversation. So that, for example, if he says that he saves 1,000 jobs in Indiana, the press should say, no, he has actually gotten taxpayers to buy off a corporation to preserve a few jobs at immense taxpayer expense.
But it's both of those
but
things.
But it's also asking the press to play a partisan role.
Right.
I mean, that's what opposition researchers do. That's what campaigners do.
Right.
And for us to follow linguistic protocols, the press would have to assume a kind of loyal opposition stance, and that's inappropriate. I mean, we're supposed to be covering the facts and the truth, not trying to sway the thinking process of the electorate. That's an unavailing strategy as well. I don't know what we're going to do, Brian. We have never faced this in the history of our republic, and the answers have not yet emerged.
Well, to be continued. So Bob Garfield, co-host of On the Media, since you have, you work 2 feet from my office, let's continue to have this conversation. And I mean this in all seriousness, try to muddle through together to figure out how to do, the most accurate, the most legitimate, the most no holds barred, but without becoming spinmeisters ourselves, journalism that we could possibly do in this unprecedented environment.
Yeah, let's muddle through together. It takes a village.
Thanks, Bob. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More in a minute.